Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the More Promising Strategies Recruitment and Retention Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session with instructions following at that time. If anyone requires assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, the conference is being recorded. And now, ladies and gentlemen, your host for today's conference, Mary O'Brien.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, I want to welcome everyone to today's session, More Promising Strategies, Recruitment and Retention. This is part two in the series, Recruitment and Retention of a Qualified Workforce. We are pleased to be able to use these teleconference sessions to highlight the work of Federal Children's Bureau grantees under the Developing Models of Effective Child Welfare Staff Recruitment and Retention Training Program, and provide a forum for sharing promising practices that are emerging from this grant program and from other work going on around the country. The first session, held on April 29th, provided an overview of issues around recruitment and retention, along with some great data on the costs of turnover, and also an overview of the strategies the 8 funded sites have been using. An audio file of that session is available on our website. You can go there and listen to it using Windows Media Player, and the handouts from the session are also posted there. Our website for the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement is www.nrcoi, that's for National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, .org. During the next two sessions, today and in the fall, we will hear more from specific funded sites about what they have done. At the beginning here, I want to go over some logistics for today's call. We have a large number of people registered for today's call, so we expect to have 50 or 60 sites calling in. We have state and county child welfare agencies, some providers, and some university partners from different states, and also folks from ACF regional offices and from other national organizations. We are going to keep the lines closed and open them occasionally for questions, as the operator mentioned. So if you need operator assistance when the lines are muted like this, remember star zero will work. But we really do want this to be an interactive session, so please jot down your thoughts or questions when people are speaking so you can raise them when we open the lines. Handouts for today's session are on our website. There's an agenda and contact information for all of the speakers today. There's a document with information on all of the grantees. And there's 3 PowerPoints that today's presenters from North Carolina, Connecticut, and Michigan will use. Again, our website is www.nrcoi.org. If you haven't pulled these PowerPoints up, you might want to do that if you're at your computer, or you could do it later as later to look at the PowerPoint presentations that go along with the presentations we're going to be hearing today. I am now going to turn the call over to our moderator, Frida Bernatovich. Frida is from one of the funded sites, and when we proposed doing this teleconference series, she volunteered to act as a liaison to the sites. So I'll turn it over to her to begin.
Thank you so much, Mary, and thank you everyone for participating in this call. We're very pleased to have today 3 sites from 3 of the grantees of the 8 that were funded. As Mary said, 5 years ago, the Children's Bureau funded 8 universities to conduct recruitment and retention projects. And we've been doing some very interesting work and would like to share with you some of what we've learned from that process. So today we have teams from 3 of the sites of both university people and district and program people. From North Carolina, we have Nancy Dickinson from the Jordan Institute for Families and Christine McNamee. I'm so sorry, Christine.
That's okay.
People have a problem with my last name. Christine is from the New Hanover County Department of Social Services. From Connecticut, we have Virginia Strand from Fordham University and Jody Hill Lilly, who is with the Connecticut Department of Children and Families. And then from the University of Michigan, we have Kathleen Colbonfala and Judy Seifert, who's from Michigan. So welcome, everyone. And we're going to be starting with North Carolina. Nancy, do you want to begin?
Yes, I will. Thank you. Thank you very much for allowing us this opportunity. It's so much fun to talk about our project. It's just been so much fun to work not only with wonderful agencies in North Carolina, but also with the other universities. I'm just going to be presenting a very brief summary of what we've done, especially related to recruitment, and then Chris will take it over and talk about how she's been able to implement much of the project in one of our very large agencies and counties in the state of North Carolina. The handout or the slides that I'm using are included, called The Right Match, Strategies for Realistic Recruitment and Screening. Now, I don't want you to be put off by the number of slides. I'm not going to go through all of these, but I did want you to have this handout, which I think talks about two very important pieces of the recruitment approach, and they're not always discussed in any detail, recruitment and selection. I am going to base what I'm saying on research. We've done some research with the 34 counties that are participating in our project, where we surveyed child welfare workers to find out what contributed to their intention to leave. And two points that they said are related to issues of recruitment. Those workers who intended to stay on the job said that they had an accurate portrayal of what the job was like and that they felt that there was a very good match between their skills and the job. And that's what realistic recruitment is all about. It presents an accurate picture of the job and the organization so that applicants can make a more informed decision. But it also is a way, I think, of introducing the larger public to child welfare and the work that is done that is so critical but is often not understood by the general public. The point of realistic recruitment provides vaccination, self-selection, coping, and personal commitment. It really vaccinates people against unrealistic expectations. It helps candidates to make a more informed choice, thus focusing on their own self-selection activities. So because they have more realistic expectations for the job, they can be more able to cope with the extremely complex demands of the work. And also, when they have a choice about their decision, we see that personal commitment is increased, and they are more committed to the organization. There's some research about the best kinds of recruiting practices, and overall, insiders are able to do the best job of recruiting people because they have the inside scoop on what it really takes to do the kind of job that we're looking for people to be able to do. Now, those insiders are people who've worked there before, who are current employees, volunteers, board members, et cetera. So agencies should really use their internal resources to recruit broadly. One of the things that we know about recruiting is that correlational research gives us a lot of information about the kinds of people who are attracted to child welfare. And one of those characteristics is a desire to help. We use that in developing a recruitment poster that is one of the slides in the presentation on page 8. So you, if you have a chance to look at that, you can see that we're acknowledging the low pay, the ton of paperwork, and the massive caseload, and the upset parents that child welfare workers encounter. But in spite of those, people who really have a desire to work with other people and who believe that they can make a difference are attracted to this field. So we should use those characteristics in recruiting broadly. The strategies that we recommend are to link the recruitment approach to the agency's mission and public image. The questions we suggest that agencies ask when they're developing a recruitment message is, what sets this agency apart from others? What's exceptional about this agency that would attract potential job applicants? And what does this agency want to be known for in comparison with other community agencies? Once you begin to answer that question, and we recommend having everybody in the agency answer those questions, you can begin to put together a recruitment message that will attract people to the kinds of organizational characteristics that you have. The way you put out your announcement of an opening is also important. So I include a sample advertisement in the handout saying that the agency is fast-paced, supportive, and stimulated. So we're looking for child welfare workers who want challenge, meaningful work, and who welcome the opportunity to make a difference. That's a little bit more engaging and attractive than some of the typical job advertisements we all put out. There's a real need to expand the pool of recruits. We need to develop new recruits among young people, even people who are still in high school. We need to look for older workers who have experience and want to leave their current jobs, or who have been in jobs that are no longer available. And we also especially want to apply our recruitment strategies for applicants of color. The more we can target our recruitment strategies to these different kinds of people, the better off we'll be. I'm going to let Chris talk about how she has been able to facilitate the implementation of many of the recruitment, retention, and selection strategies in her agency.
Thank you, Nancy. I'm Christine McNamee. I'm the planner for the New Hanover County Department of Social Services in Wilmington, North Carolina. And we are one of the county departments of social services that are part of the Jordan Institute's recruitment and retention initiative. And we have tried to incorporate the many different strategies that the Jordan Institute has identified, because we kind of realize that there's no one silver bullet that's going to solve the problem of recruitment and retention. We have incorporated the interview process that was developed by the Jordan Institute, which includes not only questions that look at competencies, but also case study, an activity that requires computer skills, and the candidates viewing the realistic job video. The interview process, we've used it to fill 10 different positions, and the supervisors who have used the process, have complained that it's somewhat time-consuming, but they have seen real benefits in looking at competencies rather than just looking at job experiences. They have seen a value in having people be able to demonstrate computer skills, as that has been a real detriment for people trying to adjust to being a social worker in an automated agency. The realistic job video is viewed by every candidate prior to the actually interview, and we have actually had one candidate who had removed herself from the rest of the process, saying that after viewing the video, that was really not the type of social work she really wanted to get into. So that actually was successful. That's actually the response we want from people who do not really want to get into child welfare. We presented a survey for the 10 different positions that social workers that were hired using this process. And the newly hired social workers felt that the time spent in the interview process was well worth it. They felt that the very different activities gave them a better opportunity to display their skills, and they felt a little bit more comfortable about what to expect at New Hanover County DSS. Another part of this strategies that the Jordan Institute offered to us as one of the pilot counties was training for our supervisors. And all of our child welfare supervisors attended training on how to look for good candidates and how to retain good social workers. In addition to that, when they came back from the training, we offered we had brainstorming strategies where we said, okay, what did you learn at those training sessions and what can we implement here at New Hanover County? And so we actually put together a list of things that could be accomplished in New Hanover County at the supervisory level that would make a difference in terms of recruitment and retention. Some of those things included advocating for additional training for our supervisors. And we have sponsored trainings, including strength-based supervision techniques, creating realistic expectations for social workers through the use of work plans, and basic training on interview techniques. We also identified other things that could change in our agency that might improve retention. A couple of those things was a discussion about the culture at DSS and the fact that we frequently have a life or death kind of atmosphere here, that everything is a high priority, everything is important, and everything has to be done immediately. So we started a campaign called Cultivating Courtesy, where we asked people to think twice before interrupting people in meetings or standing at their doorway while they're on the telephone, and think about whether or not what you're going to ask, the task you were going to suggest, is really something that has to be done this second. Another thing we looked at is some of our bureaucracies. I was surprised when we did our brainstorming sessions how many little things were frustrating to the social workers and the social work supervisors, including things like, you know, how we check out our digital cameras or how we reserve vans. We looked at, you know, how we assigned university interns, because that caused frustration and concern on the part of staff. And we also have changed some things in terms of our time management. We have expanded the use of flex time, and we have looked at technology, including buying laptops for all of our social workers and getting wireless at the juvenile courthouse so that time could be spent working on documentation while you were waiting to be called into court. A couple of the things that we're doing ongoing is that we have a support group for supervisors in which they can talk about some perhaps disciplinary issues or concerns and how they can approach that in a strength-based way. We have monthly R&R meetings where the child welfare supervisors get together to talk about what issues need to be addressed, what things we want to advocate for, and how we can change our behaviors in order to improve retention. We've begun to expand the R&R discussions to our economic services supervisors because they were envious of some of the discussions and some of the things we were able to get for our child welfare supervisors. We have been monitoring, in addition to the Jordan Institute, we've been monitoring some statistics that we felt were important. We've seen that year-to-date, our total agency turnover rate has decreased and is at right now 9%. And our vacancy fill rate in trying to fill vacancies in less than 40 days at right now is at 40%. So we are working on both of those, but we actually are seeing a light at the end of the tunnel. We think that we have to continue to look at additional strategies so that we can do many different things in order to positively impact on recruitment and retention.
Great. Thank you so much, Christine. When you were talking, I was thinking that, you know, you started out saying there's no silver bullet, and it really is a question of addressing multitude of issues all at the same time. And one of the sayings there is that the best recruitment strategy is a stable and committed staff. So if you have in place a culture and climate that supports staff, then that's the kind of place that people want to come and work in.
Yes, I think you're right. And I think that, you know, you want to make sure that you're keeping good staff, not just bringing in good staff. And you've got to work at it from both ends.
Great. Thank you. We could take some questions now. If Tyrone, we could open the lines and see if anyone has questions about the North Carolina presentation.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may do so by pressing the pound key. Again, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. I show no questions or comments at this time.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the Connecticut presentation, and we have Ginny Strand from Fordham University. Ginny?
Okay. Thank you very much. We're very pleased to be able to participate in this teleconference. And what we're going to do is I'm going to take a little bit of time to talk about some of the contextual factors that went into our project. And then we're going to focus on one particular component, our mentoring program, and Jody Hill-Lilly from the Connecticut Department of Children and Families will describe that in more detail, and then I'll come back and talk a little bit about some of the results that we found from our evaluation of this project or this component of the project over about a 3-year period. But first, let me start by saying that Connecticut is really in somewhat of an enviable position, although there are increasingly other states that are similar. And by that I mean that Connecticut has low staff turnover. For the last 3 years, the total agency turnover has been under 8%. And for 2006, in particular, the casework or frontline turnover was under 7%. So it's a very stable workforce. Caseloads have also been able to have been kept at 17 or lower, or the equivalent of they use a particular workload formula. So that's been a plus for the workforce. The pay for Connecticut staff, we think, is about the second highest in the nation compared to other child welfare or public child welfare agencies around the country. And many of the resources that have been made available to the agency have come about, like in many other states, as a result of a consent decree and the very progressive movement now out from that consent decree. So that was the context in which we were starting our project as one of the recruitment and retention grantees. And because of this, we wanted to focus on really, Frieda, what you alluded to before, which was the organizational climate. And that really means talking and helping to support the leadership, the management, and even the supervisory level. So that's where we focused. And one of the first things we did was undertake an agency-wide survey of job satisfaction. In the survey, we made an attempt to identify specific employment issues that were difficulties for the staff. And we actually just repeated that a couple of months ago in order to sort of have a a profile at two different points in time of the agencies, of the staff's orientation to job satisfaction and organizational commitment. But the survey we did back in 2004 really helped inform some of our strategies, the mentoring program being one of them, because, and I just have a couple of things highlighted in the PowerPoint presentation. Of the three groups, managers, supervisors, and caseworkers, the supervisors were the most dissatisfied with their jobs, and they were the most dissatisfied with their own supervision. They were more dissatisfied with their supervision than caseworkers were with them. Another thing we found is that the longer one stayed at the agency, the less satisfied they became with the job, and that those with an MSW degree are significantly more likely to express an intention to leave than those with a BA. So in this context, with these particular stresses, if you will, on the staff, the mentoring program, which we helped the agency support, was really targeted at supervisors being mentored by managers in order to address some of what emerged in the survey. And Jody will talk a little bit more about the program, but I just wanted to mention that there were other aspects to our initiatives, which I think are outlined in that two-page document that's also, I think, up on your website. And it included a Leadership Development Institute, the development of a transfer of learning curriculum for managers to help them support their supervisors, a clinical consultation program for supervisors directly, the development of a behavioral interview protocol for selecting supervisors, and the specific support for training supervisors who were supervising the new hires when they come into the units. So the mentoring program, I think, has been one of our most comprehensive components, and I'll turn it over to Jody to talk a little bit more about.
Good afternoon. As Jenny said, my name is Jody Hill-Lilly, and I'm the training director for the Connecticut Department of Children and Families. And I'm going to give you sort of a history and the nuts and bolts of the mentoring program, a program which we have found to be extremely successful and really has led to more satisfaction amongst our staff, particularly as it relates to supervisors and social workers. Just a brief history, the project, the mentoring program sort of evolved out of a strategic planning meeting in 1999 involving our affirmative action, our human resources, and our commissioner's office. And that was really as a result of some concern regarding staff of color not feeling supported in their promotional opportunities. So we piloted a mentoring program in 2002, and it was fairly successful. But as you can imagine, we had a change of administration, and it became less of a priority for the agency. And our desire to have this sort of carried on, we solicited the support of the Recruitment and Retention Grant to implement a full program, which we did with the support of the grant, and it really has led to the success of the program. So essentially the goals of the mentoring program are to increase organizational commitment, to build leadership capacity, particularly given the concern regarding our need for succession planning, given the fact that we anticipate a huge retirement in the next 2 to 5 years. Also to increase, even though we don't necessarily have a retention problem per se, we did, as a result of the survey, realize that we have a great deal of dissatisfaction. So if people are not leaving, they're actually staying on the job and they're really not satisfied. And we're concerned about that, how that impacts services to children and families. We also wanted the program to help staff, supervisors, and workers navigate and negotiate within DCF and in the community, and to increase opportunities for career and personal development. So in order to be eligible to be a mentee in our mentoring program, you must be at a social worker level or at a supervisor level. You also must be in good standing. We work very closely with HR to make sure that there was a check of a review of the performance appraisals to make sure that the applicants were in good standing. We also wanted to target those employees who have been here more than 2 years. We were really gearing this program towards the people who might have been a little stuck or really wanted some support in being able to move up and negotiate and navigate within the system. We also require that supervisory approval for participation in the program. On the mentor side, in order to be a mentor matched with a mentee, you had to be at a program supervisor level. In terms of our chain of command, we have social worker, social work supervisor, then we have a program supervisor, which is at a management level, and a program director and area director. So our management level starts at the program supervisor level. And we had many participants, not only at the program supervisor level, but we had high executive level staff participating in this position, including bureau chiefs and even assistants to the commissioner. Even the commissioner's office had some involvement in the program, and I'll get into that in a little bit later. But the mentors also had to be in good standing, and we made sure to check their background as well. Surprisingly, you assume that when a person is a manager, you wouldn't necessarily need to do that, but we did find some issues, and so that having that background check even for the mentors was equally as important. And mentors also had to have supervisory approval. We have a pretty comprehensive application process. So there is a paper application that solicits demographic information. It talks about what your areas of growth are, what sort of projects you're interested in. It involves a letter of support from your supervisor, and it involves a brief statement of interest. What we're trying to ascertain there is what is it that the mentee wants to work on and what is it that the mentor wants to be able to provide the mentee. When we're matching mentees with mentors, we made a pretty conscious decision not to have a person match with another person in their direct chain of command. In fact, we preferred that they were located in another office so that there would be no issues or conflicts with case decision type of issues. We did allow for some folks to select who they wanted as mentors. So if a person had worked or had admired somebody from afar, they had the ability to say, I would like for this person to be my mentor. And if that person agreed, we facilitated that match. We also match according to goals and interests, as I alluded to earlier. We matched according to the strengths of the mentors. We also considered distance. Connecticut is a very small state. You can go from the top to the bottom of the state in 2 hours. But we wanted to make sure that folks were matched in about a 30-mile radius if we could. We weren't always successful at that, but we found that the pairs that had the most problems were the ones that were where distance was an issue. We also matched based on preference for gender and race. There were some people who clearly said, you know, I'm a female and I prefer to be matched with a female, or I'm a person of color and I prefer to be matched with somebody from my ethnicity. But what we found when folks did not list a preference and we mixed up the genders and the race, we found some really sort of striking learning opportunities for the pairs who had people who they had very little or seemed to have little in common with. So that was a sort of surprise and a benefit to the program of having somebody who's a little different from you. early on when we were matching the two, the mentors and the mentees, we didn't tell each other who they were matched with until the day of the program. We have some 4,000 employees here, and as you can imagine, trying to coordinate that, we don't know who might have history with the next person. So we ran into some glitches there. So instead of making it totally anonymous, we informed the mentee who they were going to be paired with prior to the actual kickoff to make sure that there weren't any personal connections or any reasons that might interfere or present as a barrier for them to have a productive relationship. The mentoring program receives a significant amount of administrative support. We are overseen by our advisory board that is really connected to the recruitment and retention group and the grant. In addition, we have a mentoring committee that meets regularly to talk about and plan for activities around the mentoring program. And we've also assigned team leaders to each of the pairs to make sure that their progress is made and that if there are any issues that need to be dealt with, that there's a neutral person there to be able to help and support. There's a training component to the mentoring program in which day one of the program, there's a kickoff training for mentors and mentees. They are trained in what to expect from the program. They're trained in how to be mentors or how to be successful mentees. We also have quarterly meetings, which are other types of training related to professional development. And then we have an end-of-the-year sort of ceremony. Mentees and mentors are matched for a period of about a year. It's actually just a year. It is a formal matching, and you are required to have a minimum of two contacts a month. One must be in person. During that time, you would work on things outlined in your personal development plan. So some of the program activities, what do these folks do when they get together? The first thing they have to do is to develop a development plan. What is it that the mentee would like to get from this experience? And so that is sort of written down and agreed to by both the mentee and the mentor. And throughout the year, the idea is that you work on those goals identified in the developmental plans. And I thought I might just give you just a few of the activities that have come out of some of these matches. One very successful strategy that we use in the program is the mock interview process. What we have done is to simulate an interview process for social workers and supervisors who have interest in getting promoted. So we simulate this interview process, and then we have the mentor sit in to watch the interview process. And then immediately after the interview is completed, we give the supervisor and the supervisor social worker feedback on how they do on the interview. One thing that I've seen as a training director and somebody who has sat on multiple interviews is that we struggle as a profession, a lot of our staff anyway in Connecticut struggle with the interview process. But the reason they continue to struggle is because very often they don't have an opportunity to get feedback on why they didn't get a job. And a lot of times it's directly related to their inability to interview. So this has really been sort of life-changing in the lives of some of our social workers and supervisors because they were able to get some feedback that they never received in the past, and so that they could change their behaviors because a lot of times it wasn't that they weren't qualified or competent enough to do the job, they just couldn't get through the interview process. So every mentee has an opportunity to participate in a mock interview. We also have shadowing experiences where we have the involvement of our commissioner's office and very high-level executive staff where they have opened up some of their meetings so that supervisors and social workers in the mentoring program can watch them interact in their day-to-day business. And that's one of the things that has been very, very successful and very enlightening to the supervisors and the social workers because you don't really have the opportunity opportunity to actually sit with a commissioner or a high-level person to really figure out what their day-to-day job entails. And the commissioner's office has been extremely open to having this happen and have been involved for several years in helping the social workers and the supervisors grow professionally. We've had folks participate in special work groups. For example, we had a sort of controversial work group around whether or not genetic testing was appropriate for our clients or not. And so we've had that's a type of work group that one of our mentees sat in. We've had many people decide to go back to school for either a doctorate degree or for a master's degree if they don't already have it. We've had mentees sort of sit in leadership activities of some of the area directors. We even had in one situation where some of our mentees developed a community day awareness. It was a hugely successful, it was a complete success where we had, close to 600 people attend. You had all levels of staff sort of running this 5K race, and it really was to promote community awareness and about our foster care programs and DCF, and we invited foster parents and community providers, and everybody just had a fun day. There were activities for kids and just a very successful day, and that came out of the mentoring program. And this was an initiative that was above and beyond the expectation of the role of a social worker and had really originated out of the mentoring program. A lot of people choose to develop training or they're working on their presentation skills. And another sort of surprise benefit to the program is that our mentors typically state that they get just as much out of the program as the mentees. So mentors, those of us who have been around for 20-plus years and haven't been out in the field in a while, have an opportunity to maybe sit down, go out with a social worker out in the field to be reminded of what it's like to be out in the field. So that's just one of the other surprise benefits that we've gotten out of the program.
Shall I pick up with just note a couple of the other findings which evolved or came out of both our process and our outcome study of the program. First of all, this isn't on the slide, but I want to go back and allude to something Jody started off with, which is that the original idea for this program came from partly an initiative in affirmative action. And one of the things the program has been able to do quite successfully is to attract staff of color as both mentors and mentees, in fact, in larger proportions than actually are represented in the agency. So I think it's been very successful in that regard. It's also been very successful in how the program has been run, and we're running out of time, so I won't go through all of this other than to say that Jody, and her staff really have done such a good job, starting with the attention to recruitment and the matching process. The kickoff, the orientation meeting has a very, very strong training component that orients the mentors and the mentees to the relationship, and we always hear about that at the end, how helpful that was. And then the team leaders have been helpful. The shadowing and the mock interviews were very, very positive response to, as well as the quarterly meetings. And we've found that in terms of the self-reports of participants, not only at the end of the 12-month, because it is a year-long project, but also at 6 months and 12 months when we followed up, have really continued to report that the program has helped to increase their commitment, increase their skills and leadership capacity, increase job satisfaction, And not surprisingly, on this latest survey of job satisfaction and organizational commitment that we did in the agency, we found that those who had participated in training opportunities, and particularly, and this was the mentoring program was one of those, were much more likely to score significantly higher on organizational commitment. So in a lot of ways, we feel that the program really has impacted positively the organizational culture. So that's, I think, it.
That's it for now from Connecticut. Thank you so much, Ginny and Jody. We could maybe take one question from the sites if anyone has a question out there, Tyrone.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the number one key on your touchtone telephone. Again, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the number one key on your touchtone telephone. Our first question is from Pamela Foster.
Yes, good morning. This is Julian Wagner, filling in for Pamela Foster. I had a question in regards to the comment in the slide where it said that the MSWs are more likely to leave a position over a BS individual. Can you give me any type of historical data explaining that phenomenon?
Well, that came from a response on our initial survey where one of the questions that we asked staff was, do you intend to leave the agency in the next 12 months? And of those that responded yes, there was a significant difference between those who had BAs and those who had MSWs. In other words, MSWs in this agency at that time were more likely to say they intended to leave.
Do you know if that was based off of, say, promotional opportunities for MSWs, or would it be an issue of pay or any type of factors you could contribute that to? Because we had invested a lot of time and energy into recruiting individuals with higher credentials, and I'm not sure if we've seen that, and if there's anything out there that I become aware of that can help me. In regards to retaining staff, I'd like to know about it or where I could get info on that.
I think Jody could speak to the particular agency and why we might have seen that. But in general, the literature, I think, does seem to support the fact that if one does go back for an MSW, people are more likely to stay. Now, Jody, do you want to say something about the
Yeah, I can sort of give you some anecdotal information just based on what I've seen from the training director's seat, and that is that because we have such an incentive in terms of money, people sort of stay here, but I wouldn't necessarily say that everybody is as happy as we would like them to be. So many people pursue an MSW thinking that that will open up other opportunities. And depending on where they are in terms of achieving that MSW, if they've just gotten it, they may be actively looking for other jobs. The problem with the other opportunities, perhaps in other community organizations and other human service positions, is that they don't pay as much as our agency does. So a lot of them want to leave, but are not in a position necessarily to deal with the pay cut that's associated with the MSW. So that would be my guess. I think that I think this is a tough job, and folks think that when they get the MSW that it will open up other types of opportunities outside of here. But the data does not suggest that people are actually leaving. That's the piece that is interesting.
Thank you.
Okay. Actually, that might be a good segue to the question that you asked this year on your survey about were it not for the benefit and pay, who would plan to leave? Because as I remember, you had significantly more people saying that they would intend to leave were it not for the pay and benefit. Is that true?
Well, yes, which is a question we hadn't asked before. And this year we asked that question, and we had about 56% either slightly, somewhat, or strongly agree that if it weren't for the pay or benefits, they would, you know, they might be looking for another job. So, you know, that raises the question about organizational climate morale, and I think the need for the kinds of strategies that we've been talking about, because this is very difficult work, and it is working in a bureaucracy and in an agency that has stabilized its workforce. The other thing is that the higher up you go, the fewer positions there are going to be to move into because people are not turning over. So I think there are a lot of different factors that would go into that.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. There may be other questions for Connecticut, but I think we should move on now to Michigan, and then we can come back later to both Connecticut and North Carolina and ask more questions. So Kathleen and Judy from Michigan, would you like to present?
Okay. So this is Kathleen Colborn Fowler, and I'm a professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Michigan, and I'm joined by Judy Seifert, who is with the Michigan Department of Human Services and is in charge of recruiting and selecting child welfare employees. And as you probably heard, as you've listened to other presenters, one of the interesting things about the recruitment and retention programs is that they are programs that focus on workforce issues, but the primary mechanism, at least in the RFP, was to develop curriculum for child welfare supervisors as a way of increasing accuracy in terms of selection of employees and retaining them. One of the things that happened to us in the state of Michigan is we discovered that actually two universities, so Michigan State as well as the University of Michigan, had received these recruitment and retention grants. And in addition to that, the Annie Casey Foundation was involved in a series of initiatives in Michigan to try to enhance recruitment and retention and generally workforce issues. So one of the things that we struggled with initially was not stepping on one another's toes, also in a context where we had an agency that had experienced a series of budget cuts, a fair amount of worker turnover because of a good early retirement package. So we tried to fit in our recruitment and retention initiative with what was needed for the department. And what I'm going to focus on, and Judy will focus on today, is the Realistic Job Preview, a project that was undertaken by the Office of Human Resources in the state of Michigan, but was funded by the Annie Casey Foundation. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Judy, who will describe the RJP as it was implemented in Michigan, the process of using it, as well as some of the outcomes from her perspective.
Good afternoon. As Kathleen has indicated, we've had a lot of early retirements, and in 2002 was another year that we were experiencing that. And at the same time, we moved to a behavior-based interview process. So we not only were training all of our managers in how to do that across the state, because we are state-run, while we have offices in every county, we needed to train them for that, and we did that. But part of how we operate in Michigan is through a centrally coordinated hiring pool. And that's where our managers do the interviewing of candidates, and our office, the HR office, central one in Lansing, does the background checks, and we do the recruiting, and we make the job offers. And because of that project of the hiring pool, we were given a grant by Annie Casey, and part of that was to develop the RJP as well as come up with some better mechanisms for tracking turnover. And the RJP was very interesting because we pulled together a group of managers from across the state to determine what really needed to be in that RJP so that it gave a realistic job, an indication of what the job was. Our main recruitment efforts through the RJP are directed towards the Children's Protective Services and foster care worker. And our media specialist in our agency decided to go to county offices, big, small, urban, and rural, and interview employees that do the job every day. So we have actual employees presenting information about the job. The work group then came back, reviewed the tape, made some changes. The RJP cost about $27,000 to produce. And at that point in time, it was predicted that a turnover in our staff would cost approximately $50,000. We sent out to date, and this started, we started in June of 2005, sending out the DVDs. And how it works in Michigan is that once you submit an application to our office and it's decided that you qualify, you meet the requirements, we send the DVD to you through the mail and ask that you view it, return it back with a self-stamped envelope indicating whether or not you wanted to proceed in the recruitment process. So far, we've sent out 2,973. 2,840 of those have indicated that they're still interested and want to continue. 120 have said that they're not interested, which is a pretty large number, but we're grateful because, like someone else had said earlier, we'd rather not have them hired and go through the training, which is 8 weeks of our Child Welfare Institute, and then have them tell us that they're not interested. So we save some money that way. Just as an aside, I got a Lowe's Home Improvement DVD back rather than one of our job DVDs. So it's kind of interesting to know, you know, what were they trying to tell us in that process. We have found that you know, Kathleen can speak more to this, but we have found that 606 were screened out from the hiring process. And what it has helped us do is it helps us stop people from quitting in the middle of training or the first day of training because they didn't know what they were getting themselves into. Because in Michigan at this current time, we hire people with 13 various degrees, so we're not just hiring BS and MSWs. And our response so far has proved that the RJP has been successful, and I think Kathleen can talk to more about that.
One of the things that we, first of all, let me say that Mike Masternak, who is a former HR director in the state of Michigan for the Department of Human Services, was on contract with the Annie Casey Foundation to set up a range of initiatives, including the RJP. So it was actually really, really useful to have somebody with such a long experience with child welfare involved in the development of the RJP, but also in its evaluation. So the first thing that Mike did was to develop six questions that he wanted to ask of all the people who saw the RJP. And I'll just read through what the questions were. So the first one was, based on what I've learned so far, this job is pretty much what I expected it to be. The second one is, I never would have taken this job if I had a better understanding of what it was going to be like. The third was, learning what I did about this job during the application and selection process has helped me to cope with some of the job pressures I'm experiencing. Number four was, now that I have a better understanding of what this job is all about, I believe it's going to be harder than I thought. Number five, DHS, or the Department of Human Services, honesty during the recruitment process makes me feel more loyal to the department. And number six was, I believe I'm going to be able to cope with the stress and pressure of the job. So Mike developed these questions. He tried to use them in an electronic form to evaluate the RJP, but one of the problems was he didn't have a sufficient time frame. So what we did is we're conducting a longitudinal study of the child welfare workforce. We have altogether 652 participants in this study. They complete the first baseline part of the study as they complete their new worker training. So on the last day of their training, they do the baseline study. And then we follow them up every 6 months for 18 months, gathering data. So we incorporated Mike's RJP questions into the six-month data collection. But we also have been collecting data on commitment to the Department of Human Services. And we're able to do a comparison of people who had seen the DVD, the RJP DVD, and those who had not seen it. It's not a perfect design because we began collecting data in 2004, and as Judy mentioned, the DVD began to be used in June of 2005. So some of our people who didn't see it were in that initial about a year of data collection, and some of the other people were people who just weren't shown it for some reason or other. Partly, I think they were people who were hired directly at the county level and didn't go through the central hiring process. But we have in our baseline data 113 people who saw the DVD and 338 people who did not see the DVD. And we're looking at commitment to child welfare at 2 years and at 5 years. So at baseline, we're trying to get them to project how long they anticipate staying in the child welfare field. And we use a Likert scale, which is scaled from 1 to 7, from not committed at all to very committed. And what we find are everybody is fairly committed. So whether they saw the RJP or not, both at 2 years and at 5 years, they are committed at the 5-point or higher level. But there are statistically significant differences in the commitment to 5 years in child welfare, with people who saw the RJP scoring higher in terms of their commitment than people who did not see the RJP. And then to go back to the six questions that focus specifically on the RJP, we incorporated them at 6 months, and at 6 months we have 70 people who saw the DVD and 254 people who didn't. What we found is all findings were in the expected direction. Sometimes that's higher and sometimes that's lower on the Likert scale. And there were statistically significant differences in 3 out of the 6 questions. So the 3 questions where there were statistically significant differences were, I never would have taken the job if I had a better understanding of what it was going to be like. People who saw the RJP scored lower, so they were more strongly disagreed with that question than those who had not seen the RJP. The second one in which there were statistically significant differences were learning what I did about this job during the application and selection process has helped me cope with some of the pressures I'm experiencing. And in response to this question, we found people who saw the RJP more strongly agreeing with the statement. And then finally, DHS's honesty during the recruitment process makes me feel more loyal to the department. And again, those who saw the RJP are scoring more strongly agree in response to that statement. So I'll stop now and leave the rest for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Ginny. Tyrone, do you want to open it for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment, please press the number one key on your touchtone telephone. Again, if you have a question or comment, please press the number one key on your touchtone telephone. I have a question from Clint Haynes.
Hi, good day, and thank you. I guess I have two questions going back to the presentation from Connecticut. And the first one is that it seems like the recruitment and retention efforts almost emulated succession planning. And so I was wondering if you found that the case and if you found them to work well together, those two efforts. And then the second question is, being in a state from Wyoming where we have probably 12 managers throughout the state and maybe 35, 40 supervisors, just wondering what incentive do you have to get those managers and supervisors to take on additional work in their already extremely burdened timelines?
Great questions. Jenny or Jody?
Well, let me take the first one, say a little bit about the leadership succession thing, although I think Jody is actually better positioned to answer that. But, you know, I think that for our grant, the whole issue of leadership succession is evolved over the course of our grant as a bigger issue. But one of the things we had to be careful with in the mentoring program is that we had not specifically designed it to offer sort of promotional opportunities for mentees that participated in that, although I think the hope was that as a result of participating in the program, they would be better prepared to take up opportunities that came along down the road. But there was a little bit of, I don't know whether tension is the right word, between the expectation of being a mentee and being promoted that we had not anticipated. And Jody, you could probably say.
Yeah, sure. Early on in the development of the program, we made a deliberate effort to meet with the union. And in Connecticut, both the supervisors and social workers are represented by unions. And part of what they said is that in an effort not to divide, to create a situation where grievances could be filed as a result of being accepted into the program, you had to make sure that you weren't promising promotions. But Virginia is absolutely on target in that we market the program by saying you have an opportunity to grow professionally, which makes you more promotable, but does not necessarily promise you a promotion. So we sort of tiptoe around that terminology so that we don't get into problems with the union. I does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. And for question number two, in terms of incentive, I think that was probably the most surprising thing that has come out of this program. Mentors, people who have been around in the agency 10, 15 years plus, are looking for an opportunity to give back. And they did it out of their own time, and it's a huge sacrifice, and people struggle with the time commitment that is involved. But they truly, once they got involved, it was just so rewarding for them that many mentors signed up for many years in a row. They find it equally as rewarding, and I think folks who are in a position to retire get concerned about the ability for the younger staff to assume those positions, and this is their way of giving back. We do not offer any extra time off, any money incentive or anything. This is just because they want to give back, and it has not been a problem.
That's great to hear. Thank you.
Jody, this is Frida again. What you said that the agreement was that they meet twice a month. Is there a time expectation around those meetings?
Yeah, we put parameters around the meetings. We say, you know, a minimum of about an hour or so, but it really kind of depends on what the nature of the meeting is. For example, if a person is going in to observe a management meeting and that runs for 2 hours, what we try to do is to make sure that both the mentees and the mentors get permission from the supervisors to make sure that their involvement in the mentoring program is not impeding on workload challenges. So we have a minimum standard, but many people go over that, and it's with the approval of the supervisor.
Right. Thank you. Are there other questions?
There are no further questions in the queue.
Another thing, this is Mary O'Brien. Another thing we might say, Tyrone, just to keep the lines open, and I, you know, would say if anybody out there has a comment or something that they would like to share from their own experience, other counties or states around the country that may have use some positive strategies around some of the things that have been talked about today, you know, how the North Carolina talked about an interview process, training for supervisors, steps they were taken to improve the agency culture. You know, we'd be curious about hearing from anybody else out there who might want to share any positive experiences that they've had with these kinds of things. And, of course, additional questions is fine, too.
And, of course, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a comment at this time, please press the number one key on your touchtone telephone.
While we're waiting for that, Tyrone, this is Frida again. I do have a question for Michigan. And I guess, Judy, this is a question for you. I've heard about the centralized hiring pool, and it does seem like a good strategy because I guess the goal of that is to reduce the length of time that positions are vacant. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. And it's to have a central way to hire everybody so that we're consistent from one county to the other. The original intent of the hiring pool, Frida, was so that we would have extra workers trained and in the local offices so that they were ready to fill your vacancy the minute you had met your contractual requirements, because those positions in Michigan are represented by UAW. However, because of budget cuts back in August of 2004, the pool had to give up its extra staff. And at that time, we had about 100 who were out there, gone through the training, and were there in counties filling in as people took leaves or moving to where we may have a critical need. I mean, it did really reduce the time. Now that we don't have extra people, we are able to, what we do is we interview ahead of time so that, like right now, we're able to hire up to 60 what we're calling backlog workers for foster care. All I have to do is start contacting the candidates and offering jobs, because everything else has been done ahead of time. So we have them done ahead of time so that they're ready to go.
I'll just say a couple of things from the evaluation of the central hiring pool. A couple of other additional benefits were that the people who were going through the central hiring pool scored higher on the BARS, the behavioral interview. Also, it increased the number of professionals of color in the state of Michigan, which is now around 30%.
It helps significantly, and I don't mean to fault other counties in how they hired, but we don't know and we don't care. We're hiring the best candidates for the job. So it took a little bit of that. It took a little bit of that predeterminedness out of the hiring process. It's not that we don't work with them and hire pretty much who they want, because they do have input into it, but we don't know that information, so we just look at it, you know, at their qualifications and how well they did.
Right. I have a personal interest on that, so I'll get back to you later. So,
okay.
I do have a follow-up question to that, though. And with the centralized hiring pool, people are paid while they're waiting for positions to open up. Is that correct?
Well, they're already out there working. When we had extras, we would hire. We had a lot of turnover in specific counties, and we would specifically target those high turnover counties to put in extra workers. So we would say, okay, we're going to hire to fill your vacancies, but now we're going to hire five more. We'll give you a couple in CPS and a couple in foster care. We'll get them through training. We'll give them back to you at the end of training, and then you have them right there. So they are there on the job working. But with the budget restrictions that Michigan has had, we've not been able to have the extras out there.
Okay.
But we had them all trained, and they were on the job doing it, you know.
It wasn't that they were being paid.
It wasn't that they were being paid sitting in our files, nor was it that we sent them to training. They still had to go to training. You know, we've never had the luxury to have people in our files that are already trained, and all we got to do is send them to the office.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else? Any comments?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a comment at this time, please press the number one key on your touchtone telephone.
Rita, can I make a comment? This is Nancy Dickinson from North Carolina. Our recruitment resources as well as our realistic job preview video are available if people would like to have copies. I think our information is on the website, so people can email me with requests for those products if they're interested.
And again, this is Frida, and that's true of the products that we produce in Maine, both on recruitment and a realistic job preview. And the contact information for all eight of the grantees is on the abstract that's also posted on the website. So if you go to the abstracts of the eight projects and read through them and see anything that catches your eye and you think you would like to know more about that, the contact information for each of the eight grantees is in those abstracts, and you can contact us directly.
And this is Judy from Michigan. You also can contact me, and I'll be more than happy to share the DVD or any other information with you.
This is Jenny again from Fordham. I just wanted to note we did produce a manual that describes the whole mentoring program, you know, how to recruit, the matching process, the application process, the training materials are in there. So that's another resource for people.
Great. Thank you. And I actually have a question for Connecticut, if Jody or Jenny. You both said a couple of times that the salary in Connecticut for caseworkers is very high. What is the starting salary for caseworkers in Connecticut?
I believe it's around 45.
45, okay.
So, Judy, you should say what it is in Michigan.
In Michigan, it's around 38,000.
Mm-hmm. And do you know what it is in North Carolina?
Well, New Hanover County is the highest paid county for child welfare workers. Chris, do you want to answer that question?
Obviously we're county administered, so every county is different in North Carolina. But in New Hanover County, our beginning salary for a social worker is $42,000.
And that's with an MSW?
Not necessarily, no. That's not required.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If it's preferred, but not required.
So all above the national average, which is about 37. So thank
That's
you.
That's interesting, yeah.
And in Michigan, the 38 does not include on-call or overtime. That's just the general salary.
Right. Hmm. So any other comments, questions?
I show no questions or comments at this time.
Okay.
This is Mary O'Brien. I was just going to ask you all to comment on this. On our first call, there was a lot of interest in the realistic job previews, and we got a pretty extensive description of the work that you've done on that in Michigan. And I'm just wondering, across the sites and from what you all know around the country, how people have gone about producing those videos and if there's a less expensive way to do it, or if there's some innovative funding sources that people have used if they don't have grants to produce those kinds of that sort of tool to help people get a realistic sense of the job.
Nancy, do you want to respond or Jane?
Well, I will say that a video is not the only realistic job preview strategy. There are many other less expensive ones, including a nice brochure, panel of experienced workers, job shadowing, the internships that many agencies offer to students. A DVD is more expensive, but you can reproduce the essence of what you would have workers say on a DVD through other strategies.
We're looking at doing a realistic job, a DVD for our economic services caseworkers, and we are working with our government TV station, because they're part of the county also, there won't be any charge for that, and we are developing our own script and we'll be working with the government TV. So that's an option for locations that might have that.
Great.
Yeah. Because, Judy, as you know, the highest cost is the production cost because the realistic job previews generally have as actors people who are already employed in the agency. So those are not costs. It's the production cost.
Right. I think, Nancy, in North Carolina, I think, didn't you have a question and answer part of a brochure, too?
Yes, we do. We do have that connected with the realistic job preview, and actually I stole that from Frieda, so.
And I was thinking of copying, too, so.
Yes, go at it.
and that's the other thing, that, you know, our materials have all been produced with federal funds. And, people can take the realistic job previews that any of us have developed and modify them, you know, change the title and, if there's specific information to a particular state, edit that out and then use it with, appropriate attribution. But I think there are so many out there right now, it's not necessary for every agency to feel that they have to develop their own. And as Nancy said, a DVD is, not the only way of doing a realistic job preview. There are lots of other ways you can do it. Any other comments, Mary, or shall we wrap up?
Pardon me, we do have a question on the line.
Okay.
Right.
We have a question or comment from Clint Haynes.
Yeah, hi, this is Clint Haynes again. In talking about other resources, where do I go, or do you have any suggestions on how I look about the loan forgiveness program?
The Perkins Loan Forgiveness Program?
Yeah.
I know that in the recruitment manual that we developed, this is a long way of getting to it, and somebody else may have a quicker way. But if you go on to cwti.org/RR, that is the University of Southern Maine Recruitment and Retention Project website, and we have a recruitment manual on there, and if you go into that manual, there is information on the Perkins Loan Forgiveness Program and a hot link to find more information about it.
Great.
Does anyone have a quicker way for this person to get that information? If you do that, you'll also find the other information on recruitment that we have in there that might be helpful to you.
And you said it was cwti.org?
Correct.
/RR. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. We have another question from Pamela Foster.
Okay, thanks. I had a question in regards to the DVD that you all have produced, and you were talking about potentially loaning it. Are there any type of copyright or issues that we may face if we were to say, like, for example, if you let us loan that and we were to produce a copy of it, would there be any type of copyright infringements or anything of that nature?
No, this is Nancy. We don't loan it out. We give it out. So if you want your own copy, we'll send you a copy. And as Rita said, these are all produced, at least our DVD is produced with the federal dollars that we got as part of our R&R project. And we would be happy for you to use it and just give us acknowledgement of your adaptation of it in any way.
Okay. So we would just email you at the at your email address?
That'd be great. And give me your address for mailing the DVD.
And that's Nancy Dickinson, correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Thank you, Nancy.
Sure.
The same thing is true of Michigan because ours was a grant, too. We are more than willing to share it.
Perfect.
Yep. Same thing with University of Southern Maine. Any of our materials that applies to. Okay. If there are no more questions, we can close today's session. We are having a third teleconference in the fall, and in that teleconference, we'll have grantees from the New York project and Michigan State. As Kathleen said, there were two projects funded in Michigan State. They took a slightly different approach, so you'll get new information from them. And that the focus of that teleconference is going to be more on lessons learned, because at that point our five-year projects will be over and we'll have an opportunity to look at some of the findings and lessons that they've learned from their experience. So, Mary?
Great. Frieda, thank you. Yes, I would say that everyone can, you can check back at our website, the www.nrcoi.org, for a date for that teleconference, which will be in the fall, as Frieda said. Yeah, Frieda, we should just thank everyone for coming today. Thanks, everyone, for participating, and thank you to our presenters, Nancy Dickinson and Christine McNamee from North Carolina, and Virginia Strand and Jody Hill-Lilly from Connecticut, and Kathleen Colburn-Fowler and Judy Seifert from Michigan. Thank you all for coming and talking and sharing your experiences today. This call was recorded, and the audio file for the session will be on our website along with the handout. So if anyone, you know, may have missed the call or somebody else you think might have liked to hear it, they can go to our website and listen to the call or look at the handouts. We also ask everyone who's participated if you could consider filling in the evaluation form, the online evaluation form. The link for that was in the email that you got with the phone number to call in, and you should have another one today with a reminder asking you to please fill that in. We do use the feedback from those evaluations to plan future teleconferences and to improve our offerings. So we appreciate any feedback that you want to give us on that. So, again, thank you, everyone, for coming and for participating and for presenting, and we hope to talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This does conclude the program. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.
Tyrone, are you still there?